Okay, let's do this.
Let's do it.
Let's do this. And a massive welcome back to my podcast. Yep, I'm back. Chinese chippy girl, innit? I had a break from podcasting as I got pregnant and then I had a baby who's 9 months old. So life has been so full and so hectic, but I am chuffed to be back talking about all things Asian. I just want to thank people for bearing with me whilst I had a podcast break, as I had a few messages from people asking me when I will be releasing some more shows. If you have been listening to my show since the early days, I love you so much, la. Or if you have just recently discovered my shows, I'm so happy you have found me. And you know what? I love you too. Yes, I do. But do you know what would make me love you even more? Do you? I want reviews, baby. I want 5-star reviews. I want shares. I want you sharing these shows in your WhatsApp chats, on your stories, on your Slack channels, team messages. Because you know what? I don't make a single penny off these shows. And my mum is now going to have a heart attack, as I might have told her I get paid for each episode just to get her off and back. But listen up, guys. I do this as this is my contribution to the EC, East and Southeast Asian community. I am so passionate in giving better representation to our community because it bloody matters. I want to break down trope stereotypes. I want to be the number one role model to my daughters, Sadie and Lucy, who I love so very much. And most of all, well, I'm not going to lie, when people stop me in Chinatown and say, hey, are you Chinese chippy girl? It does actually boost my ego. And you know how the saying goes, if one person says it, then wonder how many people are also thinking it. Anyway, that's just my ego. But going back to the shares, please share my podcast far and wide. And if you enjoy my shows, boost my ego even more. Give me a 5-star rating on whatever podcast platform you are listening to. It only takes 3 minutes and it's completely free. You can probably do it right now. Get your phone out. So enough of my ego. I am sat right opposite an absolute food and restaurant legend. I've learned so much from this person since I discovered him when I created the EC Eats or hashtag EC Eats campaign back in 2021. And if you want to hear more about that, then do check out my previous show where myself and Anna Chan from Asian Leadership Collective spoke about this in series 1, episode 10. So my next guest, I don't know how he does it. He just beautifully connects stories with food and writes an absolute banger of articles on food and restaurants, which we will definitely talk about later. But not only this, every time I take a photo of food or a restaurant or just whatever, I feel so massively disappointed that I can never get it looking just how my next guest does it. Ladies and gentlemen, this is David J. Paul.
Thanks for having me. Really happy to be here.
I don't know why I'm clapping. I feel like this is an audience. It's only me and you in my kitchen. And also, can I just say, you are the first person who I've recorded a show with. The first person that's not my husband. He's not really my husband. It's actually my partner, but I call him my husband because my mum tells me that I should be calling him my husband. But you are the first person, apart from him, to come on the show in my kitchen and do a live one in my kitchen.
It's really exciting. I love your setup. I love your apartment. I'm just really grateful and really happy to be, the first person you're having in here, recording, I guess, the first episode of your fourth series.
I know.
Really happy to be here.
I'm really happy to be back. And you know what? I'm going to totally fangirl you here. I just think the work that you do, how like writing about food really connects it to real people and the stories that come out of it. It's just the way how you write about it. You do it so amazingly and it's what you do. This is like, you can just tell that this is completely your passion. Before I go into this, do you want to give a bit more intro about who you are, where you're from? Yes, over to you.
Sure thing. So my name's David Paul. I'm a Burmese writer, an editor based in London. I've been here for the last 20 years. I was born in Rangoon and came over when I was very, very little. Long story short, my family basically was fleeing the conflict that was happening in 1988. If you know a little bit about the country's history and the region's history, then that's sort of what my parents had consciously decided to try and get away from. So we landed in the UK. My mum got jobs up north. She's a doctor. So we basically moved around up north.
Whereabouts up north?
Northwest. So I spent a lot of time near Manchester.
Nice. I didn't know
that. Yeah,
yeah. I think you told me north, but I thought it was more north, northeast.
So we moved there when I was like 10. But before that, we were based in Burnley.
Burnley.
So just in Lancashire. Grew up supporting Burnley, hating Man U. Like, that's everyone. That's everyone does there. Yeah, and just was just basically a little shit until I was about 10. And then we moved up to the northeast, Newcastle, where I went to school. I spent my teenage years and then came down to uni. Yeah, so that's just sort of basically how I grew up and like where I've been moving around. I have a little bit of an accent. I think that's a result of various things, but I have been pretty much raised in the UK.
Nice. So,
yeah, but it's good. And then for my day-to-day job, I'm a writer and editor. I basically focus on restaurants and food. I work for the company Resy, and I do all of the international stuff. So like anything that's outside of the US, I basically handle and look after and just make sure that people are getting stories about restaurants, hearing restaurant stories and the people behind them. I think the beautiful thing about restaurants is that they're an ecosystem that from suppliers to the people who kind of staff them and who go to them and the people who form relationships in them. I think that's just a really, really beautiful setup in a way that, I don't know, if you think about like a show like Cheers, it's about a bar, but it's not really about the bar. I think like restaurant stories are just sort of
Cheers,
everywhere.
That's so old school.
Yeah, I am.
Is that still on?
No, I am.
Sometimes it's on like Channel 4 or something, is it not?
I think like the reruns and stuff like that. Yeah. But
is that the one where everybody knows your name?
Yeah, I think I see it and like I never have really sat down and watched it, but I know like all the shows and like all the references and stuff because it was just everywhere when I was growing up.
Yeah.
I'm really old, by the way, so I think that's hence the reference. But yeah, no, I love everything restaurants. I love everything in that world, but I also have kind of been quite active and sort of working with friends and colleagues who you know, have Asian backgrounds and sort of like kind of digging into that and learning more about that myself as well.
Yeah. How did you get into it? How did you get into food writing? Did you do this sort of thing when you were at school, or has it always been something that you've always done? Or
so I originally trained to be a medic. So
no,
yeah, I trained to be a medic.
You did not tell me this.
So I completed the whole thing. I had a job lined up north, but I knew that if I took it, that I would just be doing that for the rest of my life.
And so I have to interrupt you here because hold on, this is mind blowing. So did you do this at college, at uni, or? Were you trained to be a medic?
Yeah. So basically, I trained for like, I mean, I was a really bad student and clearly I didn't want to do it. So it took me 2 years longer than everyone else to finish. But it took me, it was like a good 8 years of my life. Yeah. And so...
So are you doctor?
No, I think you actually have to practice and sign, like do the Hippocratic Oath and stuff like that. And I didn't do any of that.
Right.
I just finished my exams and I was like, I'm kind of done with this. But yeah, I just knew I wanted to be not in that world, and I knew I wanted to be in sort of, I loved magazines, I loved storytelling, I loved hearing and writing about people. I think to some sort of like selfish, self-centered extent, I just felt like there were certain things that I wanted to express and kind of convey and get across, that as any writer does, that sort of was about sort of telling my own story, like in some way. And so I think that sort of led me to the world of publishing, magazines, journalism, that kind of stuff. I sort of ended up working and doing a lot of writing for the travel desk. Okay. And that was like luxury hotels, restaurants and stuff like that. Kind of entered the world that way. And then the restaurants sort of review site, The Infatuation, with hiring. I was their founding editor and sort of like launched that because they were coming over from New York basically. So I launched that. Yeah. And then I've been at Resy for 5 years, just doing something very similar. But like I do very little writing now, to be honest. Like it's mostly been, you know, sort of empowering other people to tell those stories and like basically finding writers that who I feel have something unique or interesting to say and just sort of like, you know, say whatever they want to, you know, put across. So I think that's sort of the beauty of it.
Yeah. One of the articles that I have read that you shared with me, and honestly, it's so good. It's written by Amanda Nguyen, and she is a Nobel Peace Prize. How'd you say it? Nobel Peace Prize nominee? Yeah,
nominee.
Yeah. Nominee. And her story, for anyone listening, I will share the link because I'm really bad with explaining things. But she wrote an amazing article on her mum's, adventure. It's definitely not an adventure. Her mum's journey from Vietnam to America. And you kind of read this article and you think, okay, it's just such a beautiful story. And then she talks about how in Vietnam, the moon is like, there's like a love story behind the moon. And then she talks about this journey of how there's her. So the mum is called Lan, I think. The mum's called Lan, and her and her siblings immigrated to America from Vietnam on a boat. And then she kind of, there's this new section in the article where she says there's a restaurant called, oh gosh, I've forgotten what it's called.
Moon Rabbit,
that's it. There's a restaurant called Moon Rabbit where the food reminds her of the food that her family had talked about, what they used to eat in Vietnam. So it's just really warm and so heartfelt how it's not just food that you see, that you eat, that you survive. Like there's so much more to it. There's a story that goes behind each of the food and also some of the dishes. What was the process of when you found Amanda? Like, is that something that you already knew before?
If I'm honest, I can't remember exactly how it kind of came across. It was definitely through Instagram because I think she's quite known within sort of Asian activist circles out there. I think for her work with her organization, RISE, which is basically campaigning and lobbying in the US for issues of sexual assault, basically. Mm-hmm. And so like that's how I sort of came across her, because I think she'd probably been writing or talking about something else. And then I've been following her pretty much for the last 5 to 7 years, which makes me feel really old. But I knew that she was someone, if I ever had the opportunity and ever had the scope to do it, she's sort of like a personal hero. Like I had always wanted to kind of go out to her and work with her or be adjacent to whatever incredible work she's doing in some capacity. Like just, it would have just been the biggest honor, and luckily we got to do it. And then she wrote this beautiful piece for us. I mean, the premise of it and the prompt that we gave each writer was basically, it's part of a wide project, but the prompt we gave each writer was, please tell us about a restaurant you love, and please tell us why you return. It's somewhere that has to be personal and meaningful to you. And that's basically the only reason. And I think she picked Moon Rabbit. We were just very lucky to be able to get contributions from people that were personal, super meaningful.
Yeah. It's really good. And I think the other pieces which I really connected with was the one that you did with Susie Bubble, the tour of Chinatown. Because all the restaurants that she had featured, they're the ones which I have been to as well. But then the one where she wrote about Lowe's noodles, oh my god, I can't explain to you. Like, I've been going to this place since I was, I don't know, like 8 or something. So every year when I was growing up, we used to take a day off school. Guys, don't take a day off school. You can't do that anymore. Sorry to all the teachers listening to this. But we used to take a day off school on the Tuesday because that's when our takeaway would close. We would drive down to London and there'll be my mum, my dad, there'll be my sister, my brother and me. So we'd all be in the car. My dad used to take us to Lowe's Noodles. It's not changed. On the back of Gerrard Street. Is it Gerrard Street or Gerrard Street? It's not changed. It's like a narrow, like a little hall, and they've got like crates on the left-hand side, so it's basically one in, one out, and you can kind of get a glimpse of the machines in the kitchens where the staff work, and you can see where they make all the Ho Fan. But my dad used to buy so much of the Ho Fan. We used to buy packets and packets and packets, and because we didn't come down to London that often, we would just buy, like, we bulk buy, and then whenever in our takeaway you'd open up like one of our freezers, we had about 5 like big freezers, one of them would just be packed full of Lowe's noodles, Ho Fan. And it's just reading the article, it just made me feel so I don't know, it just made me feel so connected. And I think when I was a kid, I used to cringe whenever I used to open up this freezer. I thought, why have you got so much Hofan? Why? And even just like the low noodles, the logo, mm-hmm. it still hasn't changed. It's exactly how it was like back in the 80s, back in the 90s. When I read some of these articles, particularly ones that you may have worked on, it's not just about food. It's stories. And it's a lot of stories, for example, like Amanda Nguyen's, the stories which I can really feel, even if I don't really connect with it. Like I'm not an immigrant. My parents are immigrants. Mm-hmm. But when reading Amanda's story, I thought, actually, I wonder if this is similar-ish to how my grandparents came to the UK. Yeah. They're so beautifully, like I've got goosebumps for just sure. talking about it.
I think like with it, like certain stories, I think at the age we're at as well, I'm like, we've both got families and things. Mm-hmm. It just hits different.
Yeah.
As well, because I think you wonder about the process and about the sacrifices that you make yourself and like mm-hmm. your family made. And I mean, it's sort of, if you're second generation, third generation, I mean, the sacrifices that you make are huge, but also mm-hmm. like, it's a different kind of sacrifice. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't want to say it's incomparable, but it's sort of a magnitude where obviously if you're sort of immigrating for a better life, mm-hmm. you're fleeing conflict of some sort anywhere. And I think for a lot of us kind of coming from East to Southeast Asia, I think that seems to be a pretty common thread in that there's some sort of instability or mm-hmm. something like that. And our families just wanted better lives for us. And mm-hmm. I think, I mean, even thinking back to my own family and thinking back to my parents and what they gave up mm-hmm. just to sort of come here. And they had a very comfortable life in mm-hmm. Rangoon. And coming to the UK, starting from the bottom, my dad had never had all the help he could ever want in Burma, and so did my mom. And then when they came here, it was just the two of them and then me and my brother, and that was pretty much it. Mm-hmm. I think that's sort of something that I think all of us sort of have to come to terms with on our own. And each story is unique, each story is different, even though there are kind of commonalities mm. between all of them.
Earlier on, you said that you do less writing now. Is that something that you miss?
It's tough to say, because I think I started doing a lot of commissioning, asking writers and journalists mm-hmm. who I admire to sort of write pretty much whatever they wanted mm. for the most part. I think there were things that I just sort of have to fulfill, as like anyone who runs a website has to, like sort of, you got to take care of your traffic and things like that. But then I think I was lucky enough to have a lot of scope to be able to allow people just to sort of run with the theme. I think in any media, not just sort of digital media, I think the important thing is when you wonder like why are certain stories not published, I think so much of that comes down to the support you get from your seniors, but also like the people who run the company, the people who own the company. And I think as long as you have like buy-in, and support through all those levels, I think that's sort of important. And I think I did have that. And so we were able to take risks with a lot of the pieces that we commissioned and sort of ask quite blunt questions about things like race and equity and things like that within the restaurant and the food world, which is obviously a wheelhouse. But yeah, it was quite amazing to be able to do. And I think working on that made me realize that maybe it is sometimes it is best just to like let other people have the mic and just empower others just to say what they have to say without necessarily having to. And I think that's part of the process of being an editor, is like working with these amazing people and having that privilege, but also finding people who might not necessarily have had the experience or feel like they have the training or the journalistic background to be able to tell stories. Luckily, most of the people we worked with were already incredible writers and storytellers anyway.
I actually wrote a piece for Ocado. The theme of it was talking about, it's a nostalgic feel, so talking about like childhood memories. Yeah. And they contacted me and asked me to write a piece about my time in working in a takeaway in a fish and chip shop. And I did it, but I tell you what though, it was hard. Mm-hmm. I think writing is not my forte. I think podcasting, yeah, I'll just say it how it is. Mm. It did give me a little bit of an insight with what life would be like as a writer, because for example, for me, when I'm podcasting, I just say it how it is. I don't have to think about, am I spelling this word correctly? But some people would probably think the opposite. They'll probably think writing things down is much easier than just saying it out loud. Sure. And you know what? I was so proud of that piece. I tried to stick to my tone of voice. Mm-hmm. And they did give me a hand a little bit. But then I think there was pieces when they were doing editing, I thought, well, that's not quite my voice. Can you just change it back? And it's good what you say. You're finding people who have a story to tell through food and through memories of food. And it's just, oh, it's so lovely. It's absolutely amazing.
I think we're really lucky, certainly in the UK, that there are so many talented writers, and especially in like the food and the restaurant space. But also I think obviously social media and like digital publishing has just allowed so many people to just say what they want to say. There are like new amazing platforms and publications coming out all the time. But I think there was sort of a presumption that a lot of people wouldn't be interested in those stories. But I think with the growth of certain platforms, certain like say social media accounts and things like that, that are publishing these stories and telling them in different formats, mm-hmm. other than like say a traditional magazine or a newspaper article or even like a blog post, I think people like are micro publishing on Instagram captions or like Instagram slides, people just sliding through. And I think that's also really important and really valuable way to kind of convey and just meet people where they are these days, because not everyone necessarily has the time to kind of sit down. But I think it still has the impact and people get the takeaway and the message that you're hoping to convey. I think that is just as effective as, say, like a 5,000 word piece in the New Yorker or something like that.
Yeah. Okay, can we talk about something a little bit more serious?
Yeah, let's do it.
Can we talk about Samsa?
Sure. I mean, for people who maybe aren't familiar with what happened, mm-hmm. I think it was like the summer of 2018, 2019, something like that. And someone had sent me basically these posts that this guy, the chef, had been writing, and he was like cooking what looked like really good, like classic Thai dishes. But like the captions were just like a little bit off and basically a little bit demeaning mm-hmm. to Asian people, Thai people, just Asian people in general, just using a lot of tropes and just being like a little bit disrespectful in our minds. A few friends, we've just been like talking in a WhatsApp group and like, oh, should we say something about this? I think a couple of friends had tried to like say to him like, hey, this is kind of like, you know, as people, we're all Southeast Asian of like Asian heritage. This is a little bit, you know, kind of demeaning, a little bit disrespectful. You know, would you mind changing it? And basically, I think they asked nicely like a couple of times. The guy came back to them with like basically just saying, get lost.
Is this a chef that wrote
yeah,
it?
Yeah, he wrote back to them and it was just like, I don't care. And then said, if you think that's bad, then just feel free to check out my YouTube channel. And like on the YouTube channel was like super, super out there stuff, mm-hmm. basically it was just like the sort of casual racism, not even casual racism, it was just like just going out of its way to be like pretty vile. That was sort of joking about people in Thailand or and people in the region being like everyone being like AIDS victims and comparing people in Brixton Market to monkeys and things like that. It was almost like a caricature in how like grossly racist it was. I think at that point I thought I think in like my life I just sort of had enough of people just having a go and just, you know, normalizing racism against Asian people on the internet and just in life in general. And me and my friend Liz, who she's not in the food world at all, she's basically like she's a teacher, we were just like, we should just say something about it. And I think I had like a limited sort of platform. I was like freelance at the time. We basically posted like a long series about it and called them out on the internet. And it just sort of snowballed. People on Twitter started talking about it. Like, I think London picked it up. And like, that was sort of like the beginning of when it became a thing. And it became like this hugely divisive thing within the industry.
I just need to pause you there. So Samsa is a Thai restaurant in London. And it's opened by, I think, two or three white men.
Yeah, I think the founders, two white dudes.
Yeah.
Basically, up until that point, if you had asked me how I felt about the restaurant, I mean, I really loved the restaurant up until that point. And if you'd pointed to me and said, please find an example of a place that's doing things right and being really respectful, I would have named them as being like a restaurant that was doing everything and being like really conscientious. But I think when it sort of emerged that the chef that was posting all this crap was Chef at Samsa, and that not only did the owners know about it, but they'd sort of joked and kind of promoted some of his posts on Twitter as well.
Yeah, that's so
disappointing. I think that was the thing that was like really disappointing, and they didn't really see why it was a problem I think a lot of people who sort of picked up the story didn't really see why it was a problem either. And I think, I mean, for the few of us, I mean, it was just a few writers, basically, and people of color and allies who were just basically saying, like, this is why it's bad. This is why it's upsetting. And, like, I know we've had these tropes against Asian people for ages, but that doesn't mean it's okay. Mm. And so, yeah, it was sort of this thing that became quite outsized. But I think it was part of the conversation more widely. And I think a few months after that, the writer and editor, the now editor of Vittles, Jonathan Nunn, called out Giles Corran on Twitter, the critic. And then after that, I think there had been stuff like subsequently with you guys in Chef Philly, like the Ivy Asia thing. I think it's just sort of part of this continual process of educating and re-educating people on why certain things are acceptable. And I think even if people don't really understand why, I think that they just stop doing it and it doesn't become normalized is important. To their credit, I think some sort of have, and the owners have, we met with them a couple of times and we spoke to them. There were panels and things like that in the aftermath. And they really seemed to take it to heart.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just like, we don't want our legacy to be this. We don't want this to be the way that people remember what we built. And to their credit, I think years later, I mean, I've heard from friends that they've done like a lot of really good things. And I have seen that they've worked with some like young up and coming Thai chefs and kind of brought people over from Thailand to kind of, to boost people from the community as well. I think everyone deserves a second chance. Mm-hmm. And I think people make mistakes, but I think they've done a lot to recognize the damage that had been done, but also like to try and credit the people who sort of maybe don't have the ability to walk away from cooking a certain cuisine while benefiting from it at the same time.
When I read these kind of stories, or when I see sort of white people banging on about how they can do Asian food better, and even if they don't say anything racist, it's just the way how they think they can do better. And it just brings back memories of when I was a kid, when people used to take the mickey out of like Chinese food or takeaway food. Kudos to you for always calling these things out. And with Ivy Asia as well, I think it's really important to do so. And more recently, I was a guest at the British Library. They have food season, and I think it was in 2022, I think it was. And do you know Malika Basu?
Mm-hmm.
She is amazing. Love her. She is just absolutely amazing. And she invited me to be on her panel. When she invited me, I felt really out of place because I don't work in the hospitality industry. I've just come from a takeaway background, and there was a bit of imposter syndrome there. There was kind of like, are you sure, Malika? Are you sure you're messaging the right person? Are you meant to be messaging, I don't know, somebody else? She goes, no, definitely you. But I was so honored that she'd invited me, and I met quite a few other people in the food industry as well. So it made me feel, I don't know, at first, I'm not going to lie, it was really intimidating because I was like, I have no idea. Like, I've really just started cooking, like, you know, Chinese food, and it's just okay. And I was just like, oh my God, what am I doing here? It was just so amazing. Yeah. And I think there's just so many people out there that is really making the effort. People like you, David, people like Malika, who are really making the effort to really talk about food and to give the credit where credit is due, basically. Yeah. So, yeah.
I mean, for sure. I'm sorry. I saw that panel as well. I think it was when like our son was really, really small. So I wish I could have gone, but I'm sorry. I couldn't join.
It's okay.
But also like you definitely should have been there, because I think with your experiences, I mean, and the power of language to talk about food, I don't know anyone who's more well qualified to talk about that and to describe the impact of that than you.
And, oh, really?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And also, like, I think feeling the way you felt, I think what's emerging now is so many people have come from backgrounds where they work in a takeaway. And I think that's, to me, that's the forefront of hospitality. Mm. And like, that's the definition of kind of welcoming people into your space and then cooking and explaining dishes and things. And the way that someone like Angela so beautifully articulated in her book, like
Angela Hoy.
Yeah.
Big up Angela Hoy.
Yeah. Like just articulating, you know, the challenges that you can face in that business while also facing a lot of the challenges that any other restaurant would face as well. So I think on both counts, I think they were lucky to have you, and you are as qualified, if not more, than anyone to be able to talk about that. I think as well, like, there's a reason they approach you and there's a reason they asked you and not anyone else to do it. And I think I can relate to this a little bit in the sense that when you're the person who's publicly making or calling someone out, it's sort of also on you to get your story straight and know the facts and to have to articulate and to explain why something is disrespectful or something is offensive and why something just isn't right and just shouldn't be done. I think it's a very short and intense process of learning, but it sort of like catapults you from a place where like you kind of know why this is wrong to being like, I can really clearly articulate why someone calling or describing a cuisine is dirty and is sort of is just wrong and offensive and dismissive to all the work and the provenance and all the sort of the history behind that cuisine and culture.
When you call things out, like for example, like Samsa and Ivy Asia, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much energy did it take out of you?
I'd say Samsa 10 out of 10, Ivy Asia 0 out of 10. I literally saw the Ivy Asia thing and I sort of screen grabbed it and I knew that they would delete it immediately. I knew this from Samsa because that happened as well. But I just screen grabbed it and posted it on my story. And I think because that was one of the only videos that was remaining of it, I think people ended up directing it to me. And so I can't really take credit for any of that just because I feel like I just happened to have the video. Whereas other people were like talking about it and arguing about it on Twitter and stuff like that. And you know, I just had the video.
For people who are unfamiliar with Ivy Asia, so the restaurant chain Ivy they opened up a new restaurant called Ivy Asia. They had a video campaign out which was so tropey, it was so cringe. It basically blended any East and Southeast Asian countries together and it was kind of like putting them all into that one bucket, like they were all from the same country. And it was, oh my God, it's so cringy just to be talking about
it. It was like Little Britain levels of cringe.
Totally, like. Yeah. And I think there was a bit where the Asian characters, they walked into the Ivy Asia restaurant and then they opened the door and then there was just lots of like white diners in there just looking at them and I just remember thinking, oh my God, this is just so wrong. And anybody listening unfamiliar with it, you can probably just Google it and you can take a look for yourself. They have apologized since, but to be honest with you, I felt it's a bit weak, but hey, that's just
I mean it's a process now. I think anyone who has been in like was familiar with PR media spaces just sort of knows that like there's a process to something being called out and getting a ton of publicity and then someone issuing a boilerplate apology, which everyone else does, to the point where like I was seeing people I suppose trying to deliberately stoke up a little bit of outrage just to get attention for like whatever promotion they were doing. Ivy Asia is incredibly popular and has expanded all over the country, which sort of tells you like how seriously people take it here, but also, it also tells you like the limited reach that, I mean, it did have a national reach and it was published quite widely, but I think at the end of the day, people aren't seeing those stories. No. And as long as, you know, it doesn't reach the highest echelons of media, I suppose. Like,
yeah, I think even if they are aware of it, if they're not part of the community, there's probably just like a bit of ignorance from their side. But yeah, but anyway, I'm not going to cancel anyone out. Okay, I want to talk about something else now.
Go for it.
I want to talk about your dad.
Yeah, my dad.
This is really weird. This is like a hot topic of mine. This is a bit which I've been most looking forward to. So for anyone that doesn't know, do many people know?
No.
Okay, I know because we met up, was it in November last year? November 2023. And you told me that your dad is pretty much famous. He's in a band called The Wild Ones?
Yeah, The Wild Ones. Yeah.
Wild Ones. Yeah. I've got some of his tunes. Can I play it?
Go for it.
I'm going to have to just do it on my phone. Yeah, here it is. This one is my favourite one.
Yeah. That's my uncle, Pete.
Is that your uncle?
Yeah, that's my uncle, Pete.
Okay, I will share this, but basically, David's family are famous. Your dad is famous.
So my I don't know if famous is the right word for it. Like, I don't know if anyone or that many people would know him. I think within my parents' generation, they would probably, he would get recognized. I mean, like, when we're out.
I'm so intrigued. I want to know everything.
Which is hilarious / embarrassing, as it tends to be, because we're his kids. But no, he was a professional musician. He came up in the church, and my uncle Peter played the keyboards and piano. He played guitar in the church band. And
your dad played the guitar. Oh.
But that's how my dad met my mom, basically.
Oh,
my
really?
My dad was like the bad boy in the band, blah, blah, blah. And then like my mom was just at church, and like that's how they met and started, as they say, courting. Yeah. His band took off and became very popular in the country. Yeah. And so he was basically like, when we were kids, he was pretty much rehearsing or playing or out with his friends pretty much the whole time when we were kids.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't obviously remember that much from when I was that young. I think about, obviously, my relationship with my own son now. Mm-hmm. And I sort of wonder, did my dad do this with me? Or did my dad do this with us? And I just wonder what those interactions were. Because for the life of me, I can't remember. And then when we moved to the UK, it was so different. But yeah, no, it was definitely a kind of a transition from being like this rock star in our home country to kind of coming to the UK and your qualifications not meaning anything, and then having a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old that you have to look after.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, I think about who he was and then his life back in Burma, and I think about what he sacrificed and what he gave up to be. But no, that's my dad, and he's amazing. I love him to bits. I can't extend my gratitude enough for something like that.
So were they quite big in the 80s, like, well, how would you compare them to, like, a band, like, here in the UK?
They were, like, I mean, at the time,
like, were they, like, Take That, or?
My parents would never tell me themselves, but they would be, like, they were the number one band in Burma.
Were they number one? You didn't tell me they were number one. You just told me they were in, oh, my goodness.
Yeah, like, I think I told Amitha about, like, oh, they're, like, the Rolling Stones of Burma. And then, like, she just tells everyone that now. And I'm
oh,
like,
my God, now oh we're going to have to tell everyone. I'm going to tell everyone now.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So, I mean, it's cool.
So cool.
And, like, my dad, when he goes back, and he still has that little bit of swagger to him.
Does he? Oh, bless him.
Which is nice.
Do you have memories of your dad being in the band? Do you have memories of seeing your dad in the band?
I think my brother does.
Okay.
But I think...
Is that because were you younger and he was older? Because you said 7 and 4.
I was basically like between 3 and 4. And like I was basically like 4 and a half when I left. So I think I may have some memories. My brother remembers a lot more than me. To be honest, my brother remembers some of the not so nice things, like basically my dad being quite drunk and stuff like that with his sort of his band and lifestyle. And I think even my dad would be the first to admit that, like, pretty much when we were kids, like, he was pretty much partying the whole time.
Oh my God, he's my favorite.
Yeah. I mean, I think to it now, and I'm like, you did not do any of this when you were like, because you had obviously all the help as that.
Have you been back to Burma with your dad? And have you needed to stop on the street with your dad because a fan has come up to your dad?
I think it's never like, it's not like to that level where like people are so out of reach. There wasn't the media situation that you have here now when we think of what people in popular bands now. Mm-hmm. I think people would still know each other and see each other and like you probably go to see like well-known politicians and stuff like that, or like people famous in the country, you'd still see them out about in town, like in a way that you just couldn't here. And so like people might stop him on the street and just be like, hey, I love the band, I love your music and stuff like that. When we think of fame or when we think of popularity here, like it's just nothing like what we might imagine it to be having grown up in the UK.
Right, okay.
So, pretty funny though.
This is so cool.
Yeah. Yeah, my dad's funny.
Does your dad miss performing? Does he still practice, like play the drums or any instruments?
He has a drum kit, which we finally had space for when my parents sort of renovated the house like pretty recently. And so he plays every so often. But I
does
think,
he?
Yeah. And I don't know. We'll see. Like I haven't seen him play that much. I think when I go home, I'd never see him play it. Like I'll stick around on it a little bit. I have zero sense of rhythm. So like, I mean, I'll just approximate whatever he does on the drums, but I'm glad he still has it. You gotta keep it going.
I've just realized I've just skipped one tiny bit. I want to know what your top restaurants are.
Oh, my top restaurants. It's not that hard, I would say. I think the places that are like sort of objectively the best, but then I think if you were to say like what are the places that make you happy, and like to me that's obviously what the mark of a great restaurant is, and it's the sort of place like would you go back. And so for me, like very obvious number one is Sing Brewery in Leytonstone, which is just the legendary kind of like mom and pop Thai restaurant.
I love Sing Brewery.
The food incredible. It's bring your own cash only. Like the chef is really, really talented. The food he cooks is so special. But despite the fact that it's impossible to get into and it's packed with like a who's who in the sort of the restaurant industry, it still feels like local Thai, because I think they've really wanted to look after their regulars who've supported them like the last 20, 30 years. So despite its recent popularity, it still feels like a neighborhood spot. It is literally the hottest reservation in London. I mean, it is like, his mom's phone has just died from people ringing so much, like so often.
Auntie Thelma.
Yeah, Auntie Thelma. The fact that his parents are in the restaurant like every night as well, and like you will see them, I think that also just makes it so special, because you know it's like a family affair. So like Sing Brewery is far and away like my favorite. I love Cafe TPT in Chinatown.
Right, okay.
I think I've been going there since I was like 18, and before I knew it was like in any way objectively good, before I even knew what like pork dishes or a Dai Pai Dong was or something like that. I mean, it's just very, very consistent, and the specials are great. I love the beef flank curry, pork chop rice, like all of it's really, really good and comforting. It's affordable. Then I also love Rochelle Canteen, which is sort of a slightly like restaurant industry favorite, but it's a restaurant.
Yeah, where is that again?
Basically, it's like an Arnold Circus in Shoreditch. So if you go just off Shoreditch High Street.
Okay.
And there's this kind of this like square, and it's like behind a like unmarked doorway. It's like a buzzer you buzz and then you go in.
Right.
There's this beautiful garden, but the food's amazing. Mm-hmm. It's just really delicious seasonal British cooking. But no, it's just like relaxed. Everything's nice. It feels like you're sort of like in this oasis of calm when you're there. But everything you eat will be just like absolutely delicious.
I agree with you 100% with Sing Brewery. The moo crab. Moo crab is amazing.
Yeah.
We always over order moo crab, which is always a good shout. And then I'd always order an extra one to take home.
Yeah.
I love the salad. I never order salads, but their salads, I'll order everything, all their salads.
Yeah.
And I love their salty fish rice. Yeah, oh, it's so good.
Everything's really, really good.
So good, so fresh. And I wish their restaurant was bigger. I wish that I was like besties with them, so I didn't have to like queue up or whatever. Oh, I just love them.
Yeah,
they're so good.
It is truly like one of the most special places in London. And if I mean, obviously, like for the sake of the owner's sanity, I think some things do need to change. But I think sort of in this current form, you can see why people don't want it to change.
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
it makes it so special.
Yeah, it kind of like whenever I post like pictures of when I have been to Sing Brewery, I'll always guaranteed I'll have like five people say, "Oh my god, how'd you get a booking? How'd you get?" And I'm just like, I'm just called up, and I was just like one of the lucky ones.
Yeah, it's so funny because it's like it's never had a national, or like it's had one like national review from Tom Parker Bowles.
Right. Okay.
In the mail, but like none of the other sort of big critics have been there. But the funny thing is, like, now it's so popular. Like, I don't know if they'd be able to get in there.
I've done something new for this series. So I have given listeners a chance to contact me and tell me about their Asian stories. I'll read it out and maybe we could talk about it. Okay, this is quite a heartfelt one. This is from Elizabeth Poyho O'Regan. And she has said, "We found out that my daughter had a brain condition called agenesis of the corpus callosum. Let's just call it ACC, when I went for my 20-week scan. It's a condition where the midline in the brain, where it sends signals and instructions to the left-hand side of your body, is missing. Because of the ACC, my daughter Molly has learning difficulties and speech delays, which hand-in-hand has lots of similarities to ASD. ASD is autism spectrum disorder." Mm-hmm. Yeah, autism. Yeah. "She is, however, a very healthy and happy 8-year-old now. Being Chinese and having SEN, SEN means special education needs. So being Chinese and having SEN child, well, being a BBC myself, British born Chinese, and my Cantonese is very much Chinglish, like a lot of BBCs, I'm sure. Yeah, I'm definitely one of them. To try and explain a brain condition as well as ASD to my parents and extended family older generation in Cantonese was so hard, as there was always so much judgment that went alongside having an SEN child. They would say things like, 'Why didn't you look after yourself properly when you were pregnant? Why can't your daughter speak yet? Oh, she must have got it from her Irish side of the family.' We had lots of judgy comments. For example, if you didn't send her to an SEN school, maybe she would be fine as a quote unquote normal child. I found it really lonely. It's such a taboo subject in the Chinese/EC community regarding children with SEN. I rarely see support groups for Chinese parents, EC parents or children on Facebook and social media. There's basically very little support. No one talks about it. I'm very lucky my immediate family has been so supportive. My parents have really tried to understand and take on board information I give them, and they try and explain it to other family members, especially those in Hong Kong and China, where SEN isn't that well known or people aren't educated enough on it. And it's seen as an embarrassment to the family because my daughter won't grow up like your stereotypical Asian child or go to uni or become a doctor." And I think it's really sad when I read this, and it's something that I can't really relate to, but it's something that I can really sympathize with, because in my family, they talk. The Chinese community, they can talk, and there's that, and I can understand there's this there's this kind of shame that, you know, that your kid's not good enough, and then they'll just tell other people. Then she's right, it's such a to be subject. I think, gosh, it's quite heavy actually. It's quite sad. I have met Elizabeth, and she's really, really, she's so lovely. She's actually one of the people that told me a few years ago that when you see people wearing a green lanyard with, I think, is it a daisy on it or something, or flowers, they're wearing it because the person wearing it has a form of disability. Right. Not all disabilities are noticeable. So she was one of the people that told me, because I don't know how it got to the conversation. I think I just said something like, "Oh, I see quite a few people wearing this green lanyard. I don't know what company they're from." And she goes, no, it's because they've got some sort of disability. For example, like, her daughter would be wearing it because she's autistic. But yeah, to be honest, I don't really have the answer to that. But if there's anyone that's listened to this podcast, it's from the EC background, and can maybe support Elizabeth, please message me, and then I'll pass your message on to her.
Yeah, it's like, I think the loneliness part, I mean, obviously, like, there are so many difficulties, and it's such a complex kind of subject in terms of, like, obviously the care and the approach, but also, like, the fact that this is a member of your family, you just flat out, like, period, just need to support them, and they come first, and, like, whatever the community thinks, as important as it is. And I understand fully that there should be a recognition of that community and importance placed upon it. But I think we do tend to romanticize sort of how tradition a little bit. And I think there are limits to that. And, like, to me, this is a very clear example of that. And, like, there should not be a stigma. There's like, Elizabeth needs support.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, I don't think there's any, I mean, there shouldn't even be any discussion around
mm.
it. Well, why would you put someone in a position who's already kind of raising a child and then they have extra needs on top mm. of that? Why would you make them feel any shame?
I think, each other? I think hopefully things are changing as well. I think we're at a generation, or maybe we're trying to raise up the new generation to be more open-minded and to speak out more. So yeah, but yeah, I do really feel for Elizabeth though. Yeah. Okay, maybe you've got time just one more. So this one is from Anna Chan, Asian Leadership Collective. I love you, Anna. I think she's great. Hi, Anna. So she's put, okay. Growing up second generation British Chinese, my dad would prepare our lunch boxes for school, but would get the usual Western sandwiches, for example, cucumber sandwiches with the crust cut off. Mm-hmm. I've seen and heard so many stories of children's lunch boxes with EC foods loving prepared by their parents being yucked or being bullied for their weird foods. A massive reason to why Asian Leadership Collective created the What's in Your Lunchbox, even though I personally didn't have the lunchbox experience, I'm very familiar with people dismissing EC foods as dirty, smelly, disgusting, especially British Chinese takeaway food versus quote-unquote authentic Chinese food. Anna is asking, do you have any experiences you might be able to share? What do you think about the importance of food to cultures and storytelling, which is basically what we've been talking about? Mm-hmm. I can kind of relate to it. I think I've spoken about it before, but there's been times where on my school trips, my parents would make like a tasu, like roast pork, a tasu with a fried egg in a bun. Mm-hmm. It would be in a sandwich, it would be a bun that we would sell in our takeaway, or they call it a balm cake or a bap, you know, that's what they call it.
Yeah.
So, and then they used to put it into a white paper bag, which they used to put the prawn crackers in, or the curry sauce. It'd be right, that packaging. So they used to wrap it up in there. But the other kids would have white bread, ham and cheese, crust cut off. It would be packaged in foil or in a Ziploc plastic bag.
Yeah.
And mine would be so different. And you know what, David? I just remember I used to beg my parents not to give me like this tasu and egg sandwich, but they were like, but we've got nothing else, like what else do you want? I'm like, what, ham and cheese? They're like, we've got no ham, we've got no cheese, so you're gonna get this.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm not gonna eat it. But then they would just prepare it for me and I'll find it in the fridge. I'm like, oh god, they've done it again. And I'd go on a school trip and then I would just take this sandwich and I'll just throw it in a bin.
Really?
Yeah. Because I'm just like so embarrassed. I thought, I can't have this. And I'd go through this whole school trip with nothing.
You'd just be hungry the entire
I'd be
trip.
Hungry. But back then, I'd rather do that. I'd rather starve than have the embarrassment of people asking me, what's this red meat? Why have you got in a bun? Where's your foil?
Yeah. Damn, that's heavy. Wow. I mean, I don't know that I could do that. I'm just too greedy / hungry.
I think, but I was just, but you know, like you just wanted to fit in. And I just wanted to fit in. I must have been like, I don't know, 8, 9, 10, 11, like all these years. And at the time, I couldn't understand why my parents couldn't just get me a ham and cheese sandwich, which absolutely sucks. But I just wanted it because all the other kids were having it.
I actually fall in the same category as Anna on this, in the sense like, I think my dad was already a little bit stretched in terms of like looking after me and my brother, because my mom would work sort of these rotations where she would be like at a different hospital for weeks, months at a time. And like quite often they were far away enough that she couldn't come back every night. So it was just me, my brother, and my dad. And so I think just for his own survival, I think he would just make us like white bread sandwiches and stuff like that, and like shove a packet of crisps in there or something like that. So I never experienced that sort of like the lunchbox shame moment. Mm-hmm. There's a piece on Eater actually that the writer Jaya Saxena writes about it in terms of like, actually this is something that the wider Asian community sort of rallied behind as a moment of like shared trauma. And I think it's something that sort of unites us, but also I think it's also not everyone has necessarily experienced that, but I think it's a good way of sort of like recognizing the the small differences and nuances within the community. But yeah, like I can't say that I really experienced that. I just remember basically getting these crisps, and they were, my dad would like splurge on like brand crisp, like Walkers or whatever.
Would he?
Yeah, seriously. Like, we didn't live in like a super affluent neighborhood. I mean, in Burnley. And so like when I opened my lunchbox, I just remember people like grabbing my flake or something like that, or like trying to like,
would they?
Or like basically trying to bum food off me. Yeah. But yeah, I think there were definitely different moments where I was sort of embarrassed of what we were eating, but it was never like my lunchbox.
Right.
Okay. I remember my mom preparing ribs, and she was like, oh, they're easy, you can hold them with your hands. And like, I remember we took them on this road trip somewhere. We were going to like visit an uncle and auntie in Birmingham, because like that's the only place we ever went, was to like the Burmese people's houses. And you know, like, she'd prepared the food beforehand, and it had sat in the fridge overnight, and like, you know when the fat congeals?
Yeah.
And like, so we would just be lifting it, like, I think at welcome break or something like that, we'd be lifting out these ribs, and they were like delicious, but the fat would congeal. I just remember like everyone looking at it, it's just like, what the hell are you eating?
I know what you mean. Yeah. Because when you pick up the ribs, because it all congeals, yeah, it picks up all the other stuff that's kind of inside it.
Exactly. Yeah. And like, I just
tastes
remember,
good though.
I just wanted to die. So like, there were definitely different moments.
But before we go, David, do you have any final words? How can we find you if anybody wants to message you?
So I'm most active on Instagram, just at the David J Paul, JAYPAW. Yeah, come say hi. Keep listening to Chinese Chippy Girl. Thanks. Follow Asian Leadership Collective. They're doing such good work. Donate, get active with everything that BCN is doing. They're doing the Lord's work, honestly. They're doing really, really incredible things.
I love BC.
Yeah, if you ever want to talk about Asian stuff, if you ever want to be put in touch with anyone in the community or beyond, or you want to write about food or get into food writing or to restaurants, just let me know. Just shoot me a message, and more than happy to talk about it. And, you know, I get into it.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Well, that was a fun show with you, David. Thank you so much for coming on, starting series 4 with me. Please don't forget to tell your friends about this show. And if you're sharing on Instagram, please don't forget to tag me, Chinese Chippy Girl. Also, if you have any Asian stories that you would like me to read out, please drop me a DM and maybe I will read them out in my next show. Whatever you guys are up to, stay safe, be good, eat all your rice, and I will see you next time. Bye.
Thanks, that was super fun.
Oh, I forgot how much I enjoy doing this.